I bet there was conflict also around the women working, for those women who had been working.
There was some conflict with their husbands, quite a lot. We used to have a lot of my columns, I think I wrote on that, but I can't remember. I used to just write what came to my mind, what we were talking about at the Sugar Bowl or whatever, you know. But some men, you know, they really piled up and divided their money and figured out how they could get the damn house fixed finally, fix the plumbing and get their teeth fixed and a few other things been sitting around for 10, 12 years. But some men resented their wives' independence, and so they had, and lots of, ended in complete separation. So, oh yes, because, you know, they had gone a step up, we had, and that was it, you don't go back. And if... So, it worked both ways.
You kept working and you kept politically involved. Do you know what happened with other women who sort of, who lost their jobs after the war? Did you stay in touch with any of these
No,
women?
I didn't, because I became much more of a left-winger.
Yeah.
You know, and I, by that time I was pretty dedicated, and I've involved myself right there in the left wing ever since. I was, by the time I got out of the war, I was a definite left-winger, and I had real political understanding. And I worked that way, and so from then on, I met people
and women
who were similar. Yeah. After that, I don't know what happened to the general public, because I worked almost totally in everything. I was on.
1946 and the IWA. You were working in the hiring hall.
No. When that strike started, I was working as a. I had taken a course in Duffa School as a stenographer, and learned to type, and never took bookkeeping. I took shorthand and learned it and never used it. And I was working for Vern Yeager in a Venetian blind place, and he was struggling along with my shorthand and a little job to learn the trade. And when the strike came along, Austin Delaney, who had been the editor of the main deck, I was put on as the pamphleteer. They had a pamphlet a day on the strike, and he says they needed a helper, and he says, you find Johnny, I'm not working with anybody but Johnny. So they found me, and I went on and I worked with Austin on the pamphlets during the strike in 46, and we put out a pamphlet a day and ran it through the picket lines and sent it out and so on, and we were sort of working, and then he ended up doing everything. Even on the canteens on the picket lines and so on. I became heavily involved in that strike in 46. And then I went down and when they had the march on, I was down, well, let me see, what's after the strike? I went down in about that time into the hiring hall when they cut out the pamphlets, because they had the 48 was a disaffiliation, so it wouldn't have been then. It's a long time to remember how it all worked out. But anyway, at the time of the delegations to Victoria, when we hired the boat, and they marched on to Victoria, about 10,000 of them, I was in the hiring hall already, because I went downstairs, and I worked in the loggers' hiring hall. The woman that worked there had quit, and so they asked me to go down there. I was the only girl dispatcher from Portland to Alaska in the hiring hall. Through the loggers union, and at that time of the strike, I was going with them on the delegation, and Don Barber was my boss, and he said, you have to stay here and run the office. And I said, what for? Everything's closed down, and I've been mad ever since at him. Of course, he's dead now, but I told him when he was alive that so I went down and watched them march on to the boat, and you know, it was a wonderful thing. They all walked on quietly, and then the girls that come from all these mills all over the Westminster and Sohan, and those girls were just ordinary working girls, and they walked on that boat singing, and there must have been 400 or 500 of them, and they sing, you can't scare me, we're sticking by the union. I was just standing there crying with pride watching those girls walk on that boat. They just lifted the whole thing when those girls walked on that boat singing, you know, and militant. And they took this boatload, they hired the boat, and then they marched all from all over the island and came down over the Malahat, and they camped all night around and chanted around the Parliament buildings to end that strike and negotiate. And it was quite something, that strike. We didn't win everything, and afterwards we had long discussions on where we got wrong in the strike, where negotiations should be, and how to handle the strike, although we had done it physically pretty well. they had the boat back and forth to keep all the locals and close the camps down all over. It was quite a period, and it was the first major strike in B.C. on after the no-strike clause. And on the question of the 44-hour week, which is very hard in that local because a lot of people work out in camps and they just soon work straight through and come home. You know, it's hard to enforce that type of, because they sit around for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different type of union.
Right. Situation. Right. That was the period when the IWM was essentially still being built, wasn't it?
Oh, they had built it pretty big. It was built up during the war quite strong, you know, and it was a very strong union, and Harold Prichette, who was the head of the union, was elected as, at that time, to head the whole international. But he was a Communist Party member, and they wouldn't let him across the border. So he had to stay as president of this local. And then we had, that union had a radio broadcast every night. Al Parkin gave it called the Green Gold Broadcast, Green Gold. And it was a news broadcast that went on all the time. They had a paper out. It was pretty militant.
Yeah.
At that time. And at that time, too, the wages went right up. It was one of the leaders in a gain in wages and conditions in the camps. That was one of the big fights, too, was the conditions in the camps. They had to be, they were pretty lousy. They just had at least decent food and furnished bedding, clothing, and machinery.
Mm-hmm. Right. There were women who worked in the mills then, still, eh?
Oh, yeah. They were all over in the mills, sawmills.
What kind of work did they do?
Oh, God, I don't know. They worked on all those graders. They didn't sort lumber, but there are a lot of things they did. They're still working in the mills. They're a big labor force.
Yeah,
they're a big labor force in the mills.
Right. Did the union hire women as well as men?
Yeah, that union did, and the hiring, they had union hiring right through the industry at that time when they had the checkoff. We worked hard to get the checkoff, and sometimes it backfired, too, because with a checkoff, you've got to be in the union to work. But it did stop organizing, you know. People, to this day, they suffer from it because a lot of kids get in, and it's just a job trust to them. They don't realize the fight that went on for these conditions.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
They have no concept of the terrible fights. But when I worked in the hiring hall, lots of times in the winter, or the summer, fire season or winter, I'd sit there, a lot of the old loggers, and I never thought about it at that time, but they told me stories. They didn't have tape recorders. I just written them down. The stories that I heard from old wobblies in the early days of organizing in the 30s, when they sneaked into the camps and had to sneak out to organize and sign up their members, and they'd find sometimes their organizer dead, hanging by those ties in the railroad track, and they organized on both sides of the border. There wasn't much difference at that time. And the camp conditions, when they were still packing everything on their back, the old lumberjack they came from, and their tremendous struggles to organize that union. And I listened to a lot of stories. He used to tell me a lot of things, you know, and that what happened in the East. And I was listening to history, but I didn't really realize it.
That's right.
You know, and then afterwards, when I recognized, I couldn't remember, except in general, the stories.
Mm-hmm.
They had a lot of fun with me at first, too, when I went down there, because I had to write the jobs on the board, and I had never been in a logging camp, and I got everything backwards. I'd call sling and ringer and all kinds of things, you know, and nobody told me, because that was their entertainment, me making my mistakes. But I got so I could recognize when they came. It's funny, you learn people. I'd know if they were a faller or from a falling gang or what they were when they walked in. You just get so you know people.
Wow.
Yeah, and I used to handle cash. They used to give me all this money. Everybody gave me their money because they'd spend it or get drunk. And I had a whole drawer full of all these little envelopes with everybody's money. And they used to worry me to death, all this damn money. And then they'd come and get a little bit of it, and I'd mark down what they took. And I was always worrying about this money.
It was like being a credit union.
Oh, it was me. I was just handling the money. And so they said, Johnny, you hold this, I won't drink it. You know, you keep the money, and I keep it. And then when I dole out the money to them, never was I insulted by it. I started to explain, and they never insulted me by counting that money. Never once. And a lot of people said, oh, wasn't it rough working with all those rough men? I want to tell you, it's like being a queen. Believe me, just like being a queen. I was never treated with such respect, or any of the other girls that worked in the union offices. We were treated with such respect. We were union girls, and pure as the driven snow. believe me. And, you know, and we used to send them out. We'd have these big jobs, and we'd have the plane fares and all the stuff lined up. And I used to go down to the beer partners to call them out, and they say, "Oh, what a terrible thing." It wasn't if Don went down, he had to fight him out. I just go down. I never went inside a beer parlor to have my list, and I'd tell the waiter to call my list to see if anybody was there, and I stood outside with my list. And I think they call me She. She's out there. And if they're in there, they come out sheepishly, and whoever I was, if they were in that beer, and I'd give them all their instructions and their tickets and get them in a taxi. And it all came out like kids for me, so I had to do it because down I had to go in and fight them out of the beer parlor to get them. But I did nothing. I just stood outside and held the tickets. And I had my children down there, some, you know, my little boys were getting bigger, and like Christmas they'd come down, and they'd all like to draw like kids do, and sometimes the board would be empty, the black, big blackboard, and a lot of these men, you know, they never have families, they've never been married, and they live in those old rooms when they come down, and they're very sentimental about children and families, because they, most of them were of Scandinavian descent, and so they'd sit there and they'd say, "Draw us a mural," and my little boys would draw pictures for them and so on. And then when I'd come to the job season, start racing the board, they'd all get mad at me. I'd say, "That's our picture." And I'd say, "Well, I had to put the jobs up." I'd start writing it around the pictures. Finally, I'd erase it. Sometimes they'd get really mad at me for erasing off the pictures. And every Christmas, my whole counter would be filled with gifts for my little boys. And I never knew who gave them. They just would appear there. I never knew who gave them. And I finally used to just write a thank you note on the board. And when I, one time, my boys, two of them got polio, and I was just desperate, and my doctor, I didn't have enough money, and they put my boy, Pete, when he said polio that night, and they took him and put him in the hospital, and he had that Sister Kenny treatment where they drain the fluid from the spine, and then they keep them floating in water so they don't stiffen. And then my other little boy was sick in the morning, and they were never sure whether he really had it or not, but they took him anyway. That was within 12 hours. And I was pretty frantic, and I didn't know whether they were going to be considered, they'd be all crippled, and you never knew, you know. And So my doctor put me through this Crippled Children Fund, and I still support it because they covered me on that, except for the doctor's bill. But I went in the next day, and I saw on Molly's desk a letter going out to all the camps. Johnny's boys have polio. She'll need the money. And I knew that they would raise thousands of dollars for me. And I went upstairs, and on the third or fourth floor, there was a little restaurant, and they had a collection already of hundreds taken up in that restaurant for me. And I stopped them. I said, "You know, I think it's going to come through the Crippled Children Hospital." So I stopped the letter, and I gave back the money from the restaurant, and I said, "If I need it, I'll let you know." So you can't buy that, you know. Mm-hmm. So I really had a, that was the best job I ever had in my life.
Yeah.
You know, it was interesting, and I learned a lot, and I worked with the union, and I worked, that was the time we were struggling so hard it was a fight for pork chops and political education in the union, and actually pork chops won out, unfortunately, because in the next 25 years, you can see that a lot of these kids, they just can't fight for wages without political understanding. And we did have it in that union anyway. It went out through the green gold and through the paper. And they still have this type of education that goes out through the Fishermen's Union paper and a few isolated unions. But at that time, the left wing were in control of the Labor Council. And then when they had the disaffiliation, because of course they raided the IWA here from the International, which were, the International was the right wing. Mm. And we had a split, and it was quite a leftist split in the IWA. And actually, they should have just let themselves be thrown out and take the membership with them, but they formed another union. Of course, that was impossible with a powerful International.
And tried to survive,
but it didn't work out. But the union at that time, and they've never been as good a union since either, you know. But they built the men that built that union and worked all those years, and they were into leadership at the time.
You know, it's interesting because the unions in the 40s that were the most politicized and militant were the industrial unions, and those are the unions now which opt for tripartism
yeah.
and all these
yeah.
incredibly
yeah.
you know, sort of collaboration and strategy.
Or they're sitting on their jobs.
Yeah.
And they're not moving the membership. In fact, the post office and everything else is way ahead of them.
Public sector needs CUPE, and
even CUPE now isn't taking the role they did at the first, because I know the first organizers of that, and it was really militant, but now it's taken over with such a lukewarm little philosophy. No, it's going to be a struggle to bring unions back. I see that there's a struggle within the Teamsters, which has always been a terrible job trust union and a right-wing union. Within the Teamsters, there's this now movement coming through from the bottom to remove the top, and that's going to have to happen in most of these unions. And that's why, unfortunately, it shouldn't have been a pork chops issue, that it should have had the political direction of the role of unions and the role of profits and the whole political position, and also the power that they have, the political power if it's used, which they didn't win. So it's a long struggle. Sometimes when I hear these kids, I think they start all over again. And I remember those old boys in the Wobblies and how they organized and how hard and how many fought and died for a union. And they'll have to start all over from scratch almost. But still, there is an organization now to start with.
And it's
entirely different. And I see the Teamsters, one thing that you know, hope if they want to remove the top, then it'll happen and others. And it'll certainly have to happen in the CLC, believe me, because that's pretty close. And they're too rich.
Yeah. Some questions about the IWA stuff. Did the IWA in the 40s have any positions on equal pay and equal work?
Oh, they always were for equal pay for equal work. Mm. That was particularly the women in the sawmills. And that came up in a negotiation. Those women had shop stewards and that was always an issue, and I don't think they always got equal pay for equal work any more than the Fishermen's Union still do today, but it was never negative, and it was probably one of the few unions that did work towards it anyway.
Yeah. because it was an industrial union, were the women also who worked in offices organized with the IWA?
No. Okay. We were at that time organized in the Office and Professional Workers Union, CIO.
OT Union, right?
Yeah, it's changed now. But then, and the shipyards too, but that was the union I belonged to.
Right.
And I worked there.
Yeah, I know.
It was a very small local here. They had only organized us and a few other people. I know at that time we were considering organizing the banks into it, but I didn't get very hard. But I think that this new one with the, what's it called?
Swarovski?
Yeah, they're doing this is 20 years later, 25 years later.
Yeah, they're going to go on strike.
Yeah, well, we did start that in 1940, around 47. But it sort of fell apart, so it's been in the air. But in the offices, there's very few. There's the union offices are organized, and my husband's office. Mm-hmm. They didn't have much trouble organizing his office, so it's no great victory. But they really haven't done the job, and this Sarwak, or what they call it, they're better. Mm-hmm. They seem to have a more, they're already out to organize.
They have a strategy. This is interesting around the OTU stuff or OPIU in 47, because what Sarwak does is to really try and do rank and file organizing. Like they try and set up union committees in every bank local, so that instead of them as the union going in and saying we're organizing you, they say yeah we're here and we're going to do sort of education, but you have to organize yourselves
that's
and we'll
right.
give you the resources. So it creates a really different attitude.
Yeah, it was a little bit like that in the hotel and restaurant workers when I worked there, still during the war, and we had some struggles in there. We were working for I was a busboy. And I separated from my husband. I had these kids, and I was in a terrible state of insecurity, really incapable of working on the paper anymore, because I had to think and write. I just had to have a job where I didn't think. I just slug it out. So I got this job in the restaurant. It was a Fish and Oyster Bar in Granville Street, and I was a busboy. And my children were they had put them in a boarding school. No, I was in a bad period, and we weren't organized. And I started talking about the union with everybody in the women's toilet, and they said, oh, well, it's very transient, waitresses. And I talked to so many women, and it really made me quite healthy because I had become very subjective and demoralized at that time, about my kids and everything. And then I saw all women, they had worse problems than I had, and not as much understanding of them. And I'm sitting there giving everybody else advice. Actually, as a matter of fact, it's sort of, one thing, there's no harm in work, you know. It's a great therapy. When I went to work and met everybody else, and most of them worse off than I was, or had the same damn problems with husbands and kids and insecurity as I did, I certainly didn't feel alone. So I started talking, we were getting this small pay and split shifts and talking about union. And they would say, well, all right, it's all right for you to say, but you know, this and that. And they didn't like the organizer that came in. She sort of, they didn't care for her. So one time, it's the craziest thing, we had an issue over the pie. We had a baker called Johnny, and they made the pie, and we were supposed to pay. We had to eat certain things and pay for the pie. Well, I figured I wasn't going to pay for any pie. So I took my pie out, and I sat down, and they're all watching. I said, I'm not going to pay for it. I'm not paying for this pie. It should have whatever's on the floor, not just the dumb food. The fresh tomatoes and the best, particularly with our wages. So we were allowed one meal a day and coffee, which I managed to always eat three, because with those wages I couldn't buy anymore. So anyway, I sat outside and ate this damn pie. And the boss sat with me and said, are you enjoying your lunch? And I said, it's delicious. He said, are you enjoying the pie? And I said, yes. He said, are you going to pay for it? And I said, no, I'm not.
Confrontation.
Yeah, so they all kind of looking around, you know. And he didn't know what to do. So then he came up, then he brought a lawyer in. And he brought his lawyer in, and he pins on the wall of the women's toilet the Minimum Wage Act, which was whatever it was at the time, 55 cents an hour, some terrible pay. And we were getting about a few cents more than that. I forget what it is now, but it wasn't very much. But we were getting over the minimum wage. And so they all said, look, we're already, they read the thing, and they said, look, we're already getting over the money. They don't have to pay us any more than that. I said, that's the lowest they can pay. It doesn't mean that they can't pay you more. And I'm giving my speech. So I went to the union. Her name was Emily Watts. That's the one that died. I went to the union. And I said to Emily, have you got any copies of the minimum wage act? She said, sure, take as many. So I brought about 100 down. When I had my split shift, then I started handing the damn things around. I said, here's for you and here's for you. Well, they laughed like hell. He brings his lawyer and puts it up like it's a government declaration. And I came in a few hours later and hand him all the same thing. So I said, now what about the union? So they said, all right, join us up. We'll join. You be the shelter. I said, well, all right. So I signed them all up into the union. But it takes 3 months to ratify it, you know, through Victoria. Right. So anyway, I signed up everybody just over the issue of this damn pie. You know, it's what started it. And me handing them all the same thing that he importantly brings the lawyer in for, and they were scared of lawyers. I handed them the same thing. I said, it's a lot of baloney. And so I signed up the whole, just about every shift.